Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and on this birthday celebration for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we reflect on his words from his 1947 paper, The Purpose of Education. Quote, "To save man from the morass of propaganda, in my opinion, is one of the chief aims of education. Education must enable one to sift and weigh evidence, to discern the true from the false, the real from the unreal, and the facts from the fiction," unquote. Of course, that was before Russia got a hold of Facebook. Fast forward to 2020, and we ask, what is being taught in today's classrooms? Well, according to a major investigation by the New York Times, it depends on the state you go to school in. And partisan politics are shaping what's being taught on issues such as race, gender, immigration, and the economy. Our next guest is Dana Goldstein, education reporter for The Times and author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Position. She spent 5 months reading some 4,800 pages of American history textbooks, and in her reporting, she found how the contents of these textbooks can differ across states, red and blue, in ways that reflect some of our country's deepest political divisions. Maybe you saw the article called Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories. Hi, Dana. Thank you so much for coming in for this. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's so great to be here. Thank you, Brian.
Can you tell us a little bit about your project? What were you looking for and how did you do it?
Sure. Well, I've known for a long time that political debates that can be very vociferous, nasty, argumentative in state legislatures and boards of education across this country do shape what students learn in the classroom. And I wanted to look at textbooks, particularly because once state policymakers decide what the state standard should be for any subject, these documents end up in these private companies' halls. And their editorial processes are quite shrouded. We don't always hear about exactly how they create these books. So it was really important to me to shed some light on that. We decided to look at the two largest states and the two largest markets, which are California and Texas. Not only are millions of children reading these books, but they're important because the content that is created for these two states makes its way into textbooks that are used in other parts of the country.
They're the two largest states, but they're also so polarized politically. Obviously, Texas, a very red state, certainly in its state politics. California, a very blue state.
Yes, that's right. And not just that, but, you know, social conservatives, religious conservatives are quite powerful in this process in Texas, whereas the left is really powerful in California, and not just the center left, but really the progressive left. So you couldn't really see a more different content in some cases.
So let's take some examples. On race, you note that both the California and Texas textbooks teach the Harlem Renaissance, but differently. What's an example of how?
That's right. So multiple publishers created language that was negative or critical about the Harlem Renaissance just for the Texas edition of the books. And I found some of the same language in Florida books as well, but it wouldn't be in the California book. So example, in one Pearson textbook, they say that critics raise questions about the quality of Harlem Renaissance literature. And you see this quite stunning sentence next to photos of Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes. I mean, truly classic American writers, members of the canon. California students are not going to read that sentence.
And I was astonished, I have to say, when I read that part of your article, that phrase that in the Texas textbooks, some students will read that some critics, quote, "dismiss the quality of literature produced." And that just seems racist to me. I just have to say that word and say it out loud to throw in that doubt about the artistic quality of work produced by some of those names you mentioned that was monumentally influential in the real world as well, to dismiss it as if it was maybe popular but not so good based on, you know, whoever these arbiters of quality might be.
Right.
Have others expressed that reaction?
Absolutely.
Or did you question people from the Texas State Legislature or education establishment about that in particular?
Yes, quite a bit of my reporting focused on trying to trace this language. It is extremely troubling, as you point out. And there's, you know, negative language about other cultural movements. For example, all across this country, students will read that rock and roll was really divisive in the 1950s when it rose up, that older people thought it was indecent music, too sexual, for example. But this specific language about these Black writers was only produced for some states, and those states tended to be more conservative. The explanation for this is that the Texas State Board of Education had a debate about which cultural movements were appropriate for students to learn about. Should the Harlem Renaissance even be included? What about hip hop? What about the Beat Generation? What about country music? And in this back and forth between conservative liberals on this board, they eventually decided, well, hip hop, we don't want kids to learn about hip hop, even though it's been such a major cultural movement in the past few decades of American life. We're okay with them learning about the Harlem Renaissance, maybe, but only if they learn about, quote, negative and positive impacts of it.
There's also an interesting comparison you point out on the subject of white flight.
Yes.
To the suburbs in the 1950s. What's an example there comparing California and Texas textbooks?
This was really a stunning and really important example for me in the reporting, especially when you think about both these states, Texas and California, suburban sprawl being a very big dominant feature of their landscapes. Now, Texas gives a pretty positive picture of American suburbanization in the 1950s, this idea that people were just trying to get away from crime and congestion in the cities and get more space, and it was a time of prosperity and the baby boom. The California book is, I think, more historically accurate. It just points out that this suburban dream was not accessible to many African Americans because of housing discrimination, redlining, restrictive deeds. And they also point out that many white people left cities because they wanted to flee diversity.
Listeners, we're going to open up the lines here as we talk with Dana Goldstein, who's reporting in the New York Times. Resulted in the article, Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories, and illustrates the differences in how American history is being taught in different states across the country as politics plays a role in each state. So listeners, we want to hear stories from you if you have any. Do you think you learned history differently from people who grew up elsewhere? Perhaps through people you've met over your adult life, you've realized differences between what you were taught in history class, where you went to school, and what some of your friends were taught, where they went to school, or anything like that. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Some of you may have this comparison in your own household, comparing to what you were taught to what your kids are being taught today with respect to American history and some of these aspects. 212-433-9692. So have you ever had a conversation about the teaching of history that you got with a friend from a different state and realized that you've learned something totally different? Give us a call, or even comparing your own education, wherever it was back then, and your kids' history education today at whatever age. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Another interesting example from your article has to do with gun rights. In California, a page on the annotated Bill of Rights, meaning that the textbook prints the actual Bill of Rights and then annotates it with explanations about what it means.
Yes.
So in California, they explain that the Supreme Court rulings on the Second Amendment have allowed for some gun regulations. The Texas edition just doesn't include that.
That's right. There's a blank white space next to the Second Amendment. And it is notable because most of the other amendments that are important in our contemporary political context are explained to the students in both states. But Texas is silent in this McGraw-Hill book on the Second Amendment. Now, the publisher says they created this text especially for California, this gun regulation text. But regardless of the source of the difference, students in Texas who use this book are not being exposed to this debate about the Second Amendment.
Another omission relative to California in the Texas textbooks were when it came to redlining practices in housing discrimination. Just not mentioned?
Right. Texas state social studies guidelines never mention housing. The word housing appears 19 times in California state social studies guidelines. So when folks go out and vote for state elected officials in California and Texas, these are the results.
One teacher in Texas who you spoke to found ways to counter that lack of information. You want to tell us that story?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, Brian, because a lot of educators are telling me, and I know because I've been an education reporter, as you know, for a long time, 15 years. They're saying, you know, look, the textbook is just one source in my classroom. And in fact, I spoke to Carrie Green, a fantastic teacher in the suburbs of Dallas, who is teaching redlining. It's important to her as a historical thinker that her students be exposed to this. So she brings it into the classroom. But she did say to me, you know, I wasn't quite sure where to fit it into the sequence of our state curriculum in Texas. I'm kind of on my own trying to figure this out. Whereas in California, they've provided educators with some guidance on exactly how to do this. So these state standards and books do matter. They create the structure with which teachers plan their year of American history lessons. And some teachers are going to go that extra mile to bring in a lot of outside resources and even add an entire thematic framework like housing discrimination to their curriculum. But many teachers are not going to be able to do that for whatever reason. And that's why these materials matter so much.
Let's take a phone call. Justine in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Justine.
Hi. I learned about how uneducated I am about American history when I started teaching. I teach in a community college here in the city, and most of my students are immigrants or people of color. And I remember in one of the very first classes I taught, a Haitian student of mine mentioned something about the American occupation of Haiti. And I said, "What? What's that?" And he told me, and I went and I read about it, and I said, "Oh, my God." And I started to read some more, and I realized that in all my history classes growing up, I was not taught about how Hawaii became an American possession, how Puerto Rico became an American colony, what some of our wars were really about. And I make a point of telling stories like this to my students now, because I say to them, you know, I hope that your education is not beginning and ending with what you learn in my class or any other class. You have to keep reading about these things for yourself.
And I love your story of being a teacher who learned from your students.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what was it? Cicero said that, right? That we teach in order to learn, right? I couldn't believe that. And I have a few of my old textbooks, and they literally just say, you know, well, you know, Hawaii became a U.S. possession in 1898 or whenever it was, and then it became a state in 1960. But how did any of that happen? Or how did Puerto Rico become a quote-unquote commonwealth, right?
Right. Nothing about the Spanish-American War and colonialism.
Yeah, I really like this example because although it wasn't a focus of our finished piece, we had to make a lot of hard choices through this investigation because it was so massive. But American imperialism is something that is covered differently in different states. And more so than that, over time, I think students are getting a much richer picture of that. So if you look at books from 5 or 10 years ago, even they'll be less clear on American imperialism than books published in the last, say, 3 years.
Tina in Suffolk County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tina.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can.
I grew up in Idaho, and I was telling the screener that we were not taught about African-American history or slavery. We were not even taught about surrounding indigenous tribes like the Shoshone and Bannock. And Sacajawea was from a Shoshone tribe in Idaho who was a part of the Lewis and Clark expedition. We were never taught anything about that tribe, which I think would have been wonderful. It was all very much about, framed by white people and given, you know, it had very much a white tint to it, if you will. There wasn't anything else taught.
Tina, thank you for that. And another story like the first caller of sort of bias by omission.
Yes, I will say that both of the California and Texas textbooks do a much better job on Native American history than books published even 10 years ago do. For example, both states tell the stories of boarding schools, which is where Native American children were sort of horribly wrenched away from their tribes and families and forced to culturally assimilate. So I think that we're moving forward as a country, but states are moving at different paces and making different choices as they go along that path.
Catherine in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Catherine. Catherine, are you there? Is this Catherine originally from Seattle?
I actually live in Queens now, but I'm originally from Seattle. I was raised in Seattle.
Catherine, let me just ask you to turn the radio off in the background. I think we're hearing the 7-second delay, which is probably why you didn't hear me at first, and it's a little distracting. So if you can turn that off.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Go ahead. Tell us your story.
Okay. I was raised in Seattle, Washington, and I went to Seattle Public Schools, but now I'm living in Queens, New York, where my children are going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And things that I've noticed that they're learning that I had never learned until I was an adult, such as Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I had never even heard of that until I was an adult. And my kids that are pretty young are at least being introduced to the idea now.
Tell everybody else, what's Black Wall Street?
Well, it was an area in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I believe it started because there was land available, so people started coming and marking their spot, and Black people were able to build a solid community, a solid middle class, and there were business owners and a movie theater and doctors. Even domestic workers were able to make a good life for themselves.
Catherine, thank you so much. And yeah, I believe that the area of Tulsa, a district, and I just got a note that it was like 35 square blocks, was once considered the wealthiest Black community in the United States, and it got the nickname Black Wall Street.
Right, and there was white violence against those Black business owners. And, you know, lynchings and white violence are covered differently in Texas and California textbooks, which I will point out. For example, both states' books will say that lynchings were caused by breaches of racial etiquette. However, only the California book, which was published more recently, will go on to say that those white perpetrators of violence also wanted to destroy Black businesses, and they also wanted to destroy Black political power. So there's more clarity there on the sort of political and economic goals of that violence.
And when history is taught, especially these days, it often is accompanied by not just this happened on this date, that happened on that date, but narratives of individuals or families or communities, often individuals, intended to humanize and illustrate the stories. And so an example that you have in your article, a California textbook on the topic of immigration, includes an excerpt from a novel about a Dominican-American family. That page in the equivalent Texas textbook highlights the voice of a Border Patrol agent.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to imagine two more different literary excerpts in that spot in the book. I mean, I think there could definitely be an argument for students being exposed to both of those voices. But that's there in part in the Texas book because Texas wants students to learn about both legal and illegal immigration and debates over it. It was there in their standards at the time the book was written.
So are we doomed to learn different versions of American history, depending on the politics of the state legislature in the state in which we go to school for the rest of time?
Well, we do have a federal system in which states are the most powerful players in our education system. So, you know, some folks have asked me, well, is there anything that can be done to make sure that students receive a more kind of universal narrative of American history? I think it's actually really hard to agree on what that narrative should be. It's natural and healthy that there should be debate about what that narrative should be. But the states and these state politicians are going to remain very powerful in this process because of the structure of our education system here in the U.S.
You know, it made me wonder if the things you found explain at all the resistance, I think mostly on the right, to the so-called Common Core curriculum standards, which I think are designed to raise standards nationally for the quality of learning, but also to set some, you know, common benchmarks that teachers in every state have to use.
Yeah, that's a very perceptive connection. The truth is that one of the things that conservatives and some liberals were concerned about with the Common Core was that they wouldn't be able to have these local decision-making processes anymore.
One more call, and it's Betsy in Montrose, New York. Betsy, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, it is so incredibly shocking to hear this. I've been hearing about it for the last few weeks, and it's just, like, so unconscionable. I kind of can't get over it. So I taught third grade for a number of years, and I always considered myself a subversive type teacher. We began to get away from social studies textbooks in my district on the primary level. And I don't really know why, but I think it's a good move because what we really need for children to learn how to find and use is primary source material. And without it, they're going to get something that's skewed in some way, you know, and what we have to be facilitators as teachers and teach them how to plow through that stuff and figure out their own, come to their own conclusions. You know, even at 8 years old, they can hear different types of primary source stories, and as the ones you described a couple of calls ago, and make their own meaning.
Yeah.
And I would like to be able to share one resource. I don't know if I'm allowed to do this over the air, but
you are allowed
there's a
and
magazine.
Encouraged to share a good resource.
So if educators and parents don't know about it, there's an organization called Teaching Tolerance, and they put out educational material. They're based in Atlanta from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I used a lot of their materials over the years in my teaching. They have it for all levels.
Thank you so much, Betsy. Thank you for calling in. And we are just about out of time with Dana Goldstein, education reporter for the New York Times, who wrote that big article that maybe you saw called Two States, Eight Textbooks, Two American Stories. And we were going to wrap it up here, but Dana, we just got a call from a listener who says she used to work for one of the textbook publishers who's relevant to this story. So let's see what Jill in Brooklyn has to say. Jill, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, yes. Hi. Yes, this was about 30 years ago, and I was a young freelancer, and I and a huge group of people were brought in by Macmillan McGraw-Hill to copy edit the various textbooks. And I worked in the literature section, not history. But a couple of things. One was we were so very careful, and there were so many rules about counting how many multicultural faces there were in the books, and all of the children's literature was very, very diverse, and we used to actually kind of joke about it because literally we had to count the faces in the pictures. And so
were you mostly
time,
white people joking about it?
We were just lighthearted because we had to count how many faces there were, and there were numbers. They wanted to be very careful that that ethnicities were well represented, mm-hmm. and fairly represented.
And you were going to make a point about Texas?
Pardon me?
I thought you were going to make a point.
Oh, yes.
And
so
forgive
Texas
me because we're over time, but go ahead.
Texas at the time was one of the biggest states for textbooks, and so they had the biggest contract, and we were essentially editing these books for them. And my understanding was that these textbooks were then basically distributed across the country, and that because they had the biggest contract, they were the ones who were sort of who the contract was with.
But you were making
my question is. Go ahead. My question is that still happening? Where the two major states, their books are being distributed across the country. So are the Dallas or the Texas books still being distributed across the country?
Right. Jill, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. Clear question. Good question.
Yes, it's a great question. We've heard it a lot since the piece was published. The answer is it doesn't work exactly the way it used to decades ago. Nowadays, more states are empowered to ask for the revisions that they want, but you will still see specific sentences, paragraphs created for these two biggest states, Texas and California, in your children's books and other places across the country.
Dana Goldstein from The Times is also the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Position. Thank you so much for
sharing
this important
report. Thank you, Brian. My pleasure. Happy MLK Day.
You too.